Welcome to Managing Safety, brought to you by the Florida Aviation Network, an effort of the National Aviation Safety Foundation and a coalition of local, regional, and national aviation organizations and agencies. This talk show addresses strategies for thinking in today's complex aviation world. Now, here's John Mahaney, an instructor at Flight Safety International and an author and aviation speaker from Long Beach, California, who is today's host.
This is John Mahaney with the Florida Aviation Network. I'm reporting today from Long Beach, California, and on the phone with me today is Steve Quigg, who's the Vice President of Field Services for Mission Safety International. Good afternoon, Steve.
Good afternoon, John. What a delight to be with you. It's amazing what a chance encounter at the Safe 10 at Oshkosh will lead to.
Yeah, never would have guessed. So I want to talk to you a little bit about this afternoon about what you're doing with Mission Safety International, how you do it, some of the history there, and how you're helping to improve safety where you folks are flying in, you know, in Africa.
Yeah, delighted to give some of the background and the exciting ministry that and service that we provide to a lot of different organizations, and just delighted to be able to have the chance to share some of the story and what we do and how we go about it.
Very good. Yeah. Go ahead, please.
Okay. Let's give a little bit of the history behind Mission Safety International. It was started by a gentleman by the name of Joe Hopkins. He had been a missionary pilot in South America for several years, and because of health reasons in the family, he had to come back to the U.S., and then he got involved with flight instruction with a couple different organizations. But where I ran across Joe was at Moody Aviation. Moody Aviation was at the time based in Elizabethton, Tennessee, and they are one of the world's premier flight training schools for people going into missionary and humanitarian type of flying. The focus of the whole training is just for that kind of bush flying and the expertise needed there. So Joe was a superb instructor. He was one of my best instructors that I had when I was going through the program, because he had sort of been there and done that and knew the things that I needed to know to keep me out of trouble. But as the years went by, Joe was really bothered by too many of his former students and colleagues ending up in the bad headlines, running out of fuel or trying to push the limits as far as weather goes, and just bending metal or losing their lives because they're trying to get too much done or just making some bad decisions. So he figured that there had to be a better way of keeping the people he'd trained so diligently out of trouble. So he started a group called Mission Safety International, primarily to provide some quality safety services for people working in the farthest reaches of this world, where they don't have normal access to refresher training or quality safety information, or just the sort of third-person observation, accountability partner that a person needs to keep themselves on the good edge of the flying when they're so far away from the normal access to those kind of services. So Mission Safety International goes on location wherever missionary pilots happen to be flying around the world, whether it's South America, Indonesia, Far East, Africa, Alaska, Mexico, wherever, and we'll take teams of experts from here in the U.S. and just do safety seminars, safety audits, safety consultations, whatever that particular group needs to fill in the blanks and keep their operations safe.
Sounds pretty extensive. I didn't realize how involved it was, so this is good. Hey, do you have any numbers generally, like what the safety record was and how much you've been able to reduce accidents or anything like that?
Well, there's a difficulty. We can't come up with hard numbers. I wish we could, and it's something that we're trying to analyze and do some better research to get some harder numbers. So what we have is more anecdotal. A lot of organizations, well, there are probably a couple hundred different organizations of all sizes that use airplane in some sort of ministry across the world. Probably 100 of them are fairly well known, and the other hundreds are small operations where people just have a plane and a desire to make a difference in the world, and so they load some supplies into their airplane and fly down into the Caribbean or South America or something like that. So trying to get hard numbers on the actual use of the aircraft, how many hours and locations, is difficult to do. So with that disclaimer up front, we have seen a marked increase in general statistics that we track from year to year. We do try and track the number of mishaps with the major missionary aviation organizations, in particular the number of fatalities. And those in particular, the fatalities, we've seen a big decrease from the 80s and the 90s, where it wasn't unusual to have 10, 12 accidents with fatalities in a year. And these days we go through sometimes a whole year without any fatal accidents at all. We're averaging maybe 2 to 3 a year over the last decade or so. So that in particular, we've seen a dramatic increase in, and we're just glad for that.
This is kind of interesting. I guess I'm wondering, you know, you obviously would have what we would call initial training for the pilots would take before they would do this. Do the pilots, once they're in the field, have to come back periodically or go undergo some kind of training as they're going on? You know, because in, at least in the U.S., you know, pilots have to, you know, train yearly or, you know, twice a year for, or biannually to, for private pilots. But I'm wondering what kind of ongoing training there might be for the missionary pilots that are doing this kind of work.
Sure, and that's a good question. And the answer is that it's really all over the board. The sort of the tradition that we've inherited in the mission aviation world is a lot of people have the impression that we're just a bunch of cowboys with a Bible stuck under our arms and off we go blazing into the wilderness. And certainly in the early days, missionary aviation really started when a lot of the pilots came out of World War II with a pilot's license and a desire to make a difference after seeing all the hardships and agony that from their war years. And so they would take airplanes and fly into places like Africa or South America, into the really remote areas. And as long as nobody was actively shooting at them, they thought life was pretty good and, you know, it was a lot better than what they had during the war. And so if they crunched an airplane or two out of the year, they figured they were doing themselves pretty good. But it sort of took an entrepreneurial renegade spirit to be able to just pick up a family and go into places like that. And so some of those attitudes have just stayed with our missions throughout the years. But it's really has changed dramatically over the last couple of decades where organizations realize, no, we can't do that. We really need to be professional. And so there's been a huge improvement over what is required, the standards that are put in place, the operations manuals that people go by, and so on and so forth. So the organizations that have been around for a long time and have their act together are very strict as far as the initial pilot training, the evaluations before somebody ever goes overseas, biannual or, well, yearly or even twice yearly flight checks just to make sure that they're up to standards and recurrency training and all the rest of that. Yet there are still some small organizations that haven't gotten on board with that, and those in particular are the ones that we try and identify and work with them and help bring them into the 21st century as far as standards and expectations go. And that's where we find a real sense of ministry when we can help folks like that.
Sure. I would guess it's, you know, as you said, it's across the board. It varies from some who've got a very, regimented training program and others that are just, almost cowboy-like in what they're doing. I can tell you from the time I spent in Alaska as a bush pilot, you know, some of the public perception of bush piloting is, you know, just wild and crazy out there, but almost reckless. But actually, as I learned from taking a mountain flying course in Idaho several years ago, it actually takes a greater degree of precision in the wilderness, you know, in the mountain strips, to be on your airspeed and to have a, know how to properly get in and out of a mountain strip where you're not flying a traditional approach and landing, different traffic patterns and that. So it takes a lot of precision, much more precise than many people might be aware of, and I'm sure the same thing applies to what your pilots are doing.
Yes, absolutely. For people that just casually ask, you know, I try and put it in the analogy that it takes every bit as much training and expertise to be a good bush pilot as it does for a captain flying a 777 across the Atlantic. Now, it's very much a different skill set and requirements, but to do it well, to do it with precision, and to do it safely, yes, you have to be on top of your game, know your equipment very, very well, know the nuances of the airstrips and the atmosphere that's working on that particular airstrip, and be prepared to adjust accordingly. So very demanding, and the pilots that last a long time are the ones who are sharp to begin with, but more importantly, realize what their limitations are and stay comfortably within their limitations. So it's not necessarily the sharpest stick in the bag that we want out there flying in these airstrips. It's the ones that have a good skill set, but also know their limitations and know when to make the tough decisions to go back or to make the go around or just to abort the landing altogether and save it for another day.
Yeah, a good part of it is, you know, knowing when not to go, the judgment and all that, and you're dealing with some airstrips that, I mean, most pilots would look at them and say, no way, or how would I even do this? So there's obviously some art and some science to knowing how to get into it. In fact, there was recently someone sent me a video, and I'm sure you've seen it, of is it flying a Pilatus PT-7 into some strips in Indonesia, which was amazing to watch, absolutely fascinating to watch. So, you know, they're dealing with just the least as far as strips, you know, short and unprepared or however they are maintained compared to, you know, thousands of feet of pavement that we have here. So it's a whole different way of flying, you know.
Absolutely. That's correct. You know, we sometimes we have these discussions among our groups, and sometimes we think, yeah, we might be advertising for the wrong type of pilot because we show some of our craziest and most remote and most challenging airstrips and, yeah, sort of put it out there on a poster and ask the question, you know, are you up to this? And maybe the question or the advertising we should be for our pilots is, you know, do you have the expertise to say no to an airstrip like this when the time is right? Or, you know, how do you make the proper decisions for, you know, going into a strip or not going into a strip? Yeah, we don't want the wild guys that just go blazing off and doing their own thing, but we want people who can take an airstrip like that, make good judgment calls, do the training, and do the evaluations in a safe environment or under benign weather conditions or whatever, to learn the nuances and learn the margins that are needed to be able to operate safely into a strip like that. So it's, you know, somebody who does it isn't just going off on a weekend jaunt and going into these airstrips. It's it looks hairy, but oftentimes there are very good margins built into the approaches and very good training going into operating into those things in the first place. And so it's demanding, but within limits that can be done well and be done safely.
Yeah, in fact, I remember years ago when I was up in Alaska and I learned that the native villagers, when we would fly into a strip, would kind of size up a pilot unbeknownst to me when we were flying in, and they'd seen enough pilots, you know, come and go, and there were some that would refuse to get into an airplane because they didn't like the way somebody approached the strip, and others, they would get on the airplane. So it would, as someone told me later, you know, they're watching you and they're evaluating you because they've been here for many years and they kind of know what to look for, which I thought was interesting. So, you know, I didn't have anyone not get on my airplane, but it was when you go into places, you know, across from Homer, Port Graham and Nanwalek and that, you know, you have to know what you're doing to get in there. I don't think they're nearly as rough as anything you folks have been into in Africa, but it was a new challenge for me, having been from the Midwest where we've got a lot of, you know, hard surface, you know, runways. I'm from the civilized world, and this was it was a lot of fun, but they showed me how to do it the right way, which was the important thing. You know, still flying a stabilized approach, which we preach, you know. So there's an element of that as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned the people just looking at the pilot and judging them by what they observe. Part of our auditing process, which makes us different in a lot of ways from what you consider traditional auditing program, is that we use a lot of interviews with the staff. You interview as much of the organization as we can when we go into a certain location, from the CEO or the director of the flight ops all the way down to the person who is maybe sweeping the hangar floor or loading the baggage into the aircraft or whatever, just because we realize that everybody has their foot in the cockpit in one way or the other, and a lot of people are observing. Even when we do interviews with passengers that have no idea how to fly an airplane or what the technical aspects are of a flight are, we can pick up an amazing amount of information just by asking the type of questions. You know, how do you feel when you fly with this pilot? What are the things that make you comfortable or not comfortable? You know, any close calls you like to relate? And it's surprising how quickly they will open up, and it's very easy to see, you know, how comfortable they are with a particular pilot or the comments they'll make about somebody. So they might not understand the technical aspects of it, but at
right.
the same time, they are picking up some of the nuances, the unspoken qualities that make a difference in how a pilot operates. You know, just the confidence they exhibit, the smoothness of their flying, the how well they communicate, and all of these things, which are really a part of the safety package.
Yeah, many times, you know, people don't realize what their actions perceive, what, you know, just the body language and that. And for the non-flying public, they pick up on things. It reminds me a lot of the book I've read about Southwest Airlines years ago and how they would, you know, look for the total person, not just the pilot, and how did this person treat everybody along the way? What was his demeanor and attitude? We know he's got flying skills, but what's he going to be like to fly with? Is he a jerk or is he a good man and a good leader? So you want similar qualities, because you're trying to develop a culture, a safety-minded culture, and someone who can do the job responsibly and who's going to know when to back down and say, tell folks, you know, we can't do it today, or this is not the right time to do this mission or something.
Yep, very much so.
Wow, excellent. Would there be anything else that you would want folks to know about, or what sort of individuals you might be looking for or things like that, maybe beyond piloting skills or just in general?
Yeah, thanks for asking. Mission Safety International as an organization is very lean, and purposely so. We don't want to wrap up a lot of resources in staffing and offices and whatnot. So we're relatively small as an organization, but we sure use a huge horde of volunteer experts. So we provide the platform and the logistics and the opportunity for a lot of people to be able to donate the services and their expertise in places where they would never have an opportunity to go otherwise. So we have people that come out of, the mission and humanitarian flying background, but we have a lot of people from military or airline or charter operation, or particularly the people that we like to get involved with, people with good maintenance experience on aircraft like high-performance single-engine Cessnas and some of the turbines like the Cessna Caravan or the PC-6 or the PC-12, that kind of expertise that we can take on site and just pull the people out of the normal routine and work with them for a few days in a safety stand-down or safety seminar type of environment. So we're looking for people that, have the time and the means to travel with us. Sometimes we work with flight training schools or maintenance training schools right here in the U.S., so that makes it relatively easy to get to. But a lot of times, yes, we'll be overseas, South America, Africa, the Far East, and so taking teams generally somewhere between 4 and 6 people at a time just to go on location and spend a week or 2 weeks traveling and visiting these different organizations and making a difference. It's amazing that, I worked for 20 years in Africa, so I know I've been on the receiving end of this sort of thing, but it's amazing what a difference just having somebody from the outside world come in that are really concerned about you and have some expertise they're willing to share and are willing to get involved in your life and share their expertise and help you along the way, that it's just a great encouragement, very well received, and just delighted to be able to share the experiences back and forth with each other. So it's a great organization, a great mode for doing it, and great opportunities for a lot of people who want to get involved that way. So the best place to start is just to go to our website, which is MSI Safety. So it's Mike Sierra India. safety.org, and so there's a lot of information about us as an organization and contact information. You can also email us at info@msisafety.org, and you'll get a response in due time that way as well.
Very good, Steve. Thanks. Would there be any, for pilots in that additional or different requirements that you might be looking for besides, the usual flight time? I mean, maybe additional PIC time or some backcountry experience or mountain flying or any kind of niche training that might help to make someone, better prepared for this kind of flying, or is that something you folks address when you, as part of your training?
The training by individual organizations sort of depends on how well established the organization is. The larger organizations will have their own in-house training departments that can develop a pilot. So what they're looking for primarily is somebody that is commercially rated instrument, generally 400 to 500 hours of flight experience, especially the more time you have in high-performance single-engine Cessnas, the better off it is. But the most important quality that an organization is looking for is somebody that has good, sharp, disciplined flying skills to begin with, and a person that is teachable. If you have those two qualities in place, the rest of it can be taught and developed. But if you don't have that in the first place, you might have somebody with 5,000 hours of experience that is just hopeless as far as training them for a mission field type of flying. So if they come with a good skill set to begin with, that's great. And the rest of it, you know, as far as backcountry experience or, you know, the high-performance Cessnas experience or the bush flying or, you know, commercial type of flying, a charter type of thing, those are add-ons and help the process along. And some organizations might need somebody that well-developed already that don't have the training facilities in hand. But generally speaking, give us a good pilot and we'll train them to where they need to be.
That sounds good. In fact, I've found frequently in my line of work, working with professionals, the ones that are easiest to work with are people that come in here with a sense of humility and a willingness to learn. In other words, they don't know it all, even though they've been doing this for a few years.
Yeah, which is sort of counterintuitive to most pilots. You know, every pilot is above average in one way or another, or so we think. So, yeah, it takes a certain amount of humility and the realization that, yeah, we don't know it all, and we've got to be able to relearn it. So, you know, somebody that comes out of an airline experience that's got 20,000 hours in Boeing 777s or 767s or whatever is not necessarily the candidate we're looking for to take a Cessna 206 into a 2,000-foot airstrip on the side of a mountain. So it's a very specific skill set, but, if you give us the right pilot, generally speaking, we can make you work.
Yeah, well, these are just new and different challenges, but for the right person, it could be. It sounds like it could be a very rewarding career. And just curious, do people ever alternate? You know, rotate time in the field and then back home or something, or is it? I guess once they're over there, then they're over there for the duration or something.
Generally speaking, contracts go for about 3 years. It takes a certain amount of time to learn the culture, to learn the routines, learn a different air traffic control system, to learn the equipment, the airstrips, et cetera. So there's a fair amount of investment that goes into getting a pilot out there and up to speed to begin with. So if they're not there for like 3 years, you don't really get your money out of the investment that's gone into getting them there. But, at the end of 3 years or whatever the contract happens to be, everybody takes an evaluation and decides whether it's time to re-up or go into something else. So a lot of people do 1, 2, 3 contracts overseas, then transition back into the home office setting, right, either in the training department or fundraising or maintenance preparation. A variety of expertise is needed back at the home front as well.
Okay, very good. Well, it sounds like obviously, well-run, and you've been doing this long enough, the organization, you guys have a good handle on what it takes. So appreciate all of that. Appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about this and possibly even a follow-up at some point. So thank you very much for your time today, Steve, and appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
John, it's been a delight. Thank you for the opportunity to share a little bit of our story, and have a great day.
Yeah, we'll follow up. Thank you so much, Steve.
We hope you've enjoyed today's Managing Safety, brought to you by the Florida Aviation Network, an effort of the National Aviation Safety Foundation and a coalition of local, regional, and national aviation organizations and agencies. Please visit our studio website to hear past programs.